Thanks for joining the A Dimeback Podcast, the championship edition. I am Tyler Wilkinson, and we're joined by...
Hi, I'm Alex Cohen, producer of the podcast.
I'm Megan Bard, writer, and still the token chick.
I am Peter Bard, the one who's right about any disagreements.
All right, what do we got today?
I remember one of us wrote something about how big a deal it was going to be late in the season that this team was so good at shooting free throws because it was going to make them very difficult to catch in a close game. And then I remember after the championship game, Calipari talking about how they weren't fouling late because they just knew it wasn't going to do any good.
Yeah.
Who wrote that? What clever person?
Not for nothing, but I also wrote about that too.
I wrote about it first. I wrote about the ramifications of it. Plus, you copy me.
That's a lie.
I do think it's pretty telling. I mean, obviously, so the last podcast we did was after UConn's, I think, 33-point loss to Louisville in the regular season, and then we didn't do one since then. And I think it's pretty obvious once Ollie got to the tournament, he was incredibly adept at making the other team play towards UConn's strengths.
You know, I was listening to our podcast, which makes me sound like really egomaniacal, but I was just trying to figure out what we talked about last time, and we were joking about having Daniels at the five and playing with like four guards, and they actually did that in the tournament.
And it didn't work that well. Remember when they were playing Iowa State and they went...
It worked for a while. It worked for a while when they...
It didn't. He went to that late, and they just started scoring layup after layup after layup. At the game. Tim Fontenot and I were losing our minds.
Well, they did it the first time they did it, it worked. Then they went back to it, and it worked a lot less well. But
they did do that a few times against Florida, though.
Yeah.
And it did work against Florida, which was surprising.
Yeah, I mean, at certain points, Ollie really effectively changed the pace of those games and put his best shooting lineup on the floor, which again translated to all those free throws, but also it made UConn's defense just incredible with its speed and aggression. Especially, I thought Ryan Boatwright's defense in the championship was like Ricky Moore-esque.
It was
some of the best.
He was
guard
pretty dynamite
I've
all the way down the
seen.
Stretch.
You know what it was too? I mean, everything about this team is consistency. I mean, it was every trip down the floor. He was hassling the other point guard every single trip down the floor without fail. He didn't take any plays off.
Yeah. And I'm going to give Ollie credit for that because it seemed, I mean, certainly in some of those big games down the stretch when we talked about he appeared to be getting outcoached, and I think he was getting outcoached by Larry Brown, sorry, and Rick Pitino.
Yeah.
That, you know, he certainly adjusted his strategy, and I think that defensive pressure, which was not that evident in those games where UConn was getting beaten in the regular season, just showed up. Yeah. On a whole new level, and at some point, part of that credit is game plan.
Yeah, but Terrence Samuel started getting a lot of minutes, and he also was a big on-ball pressure defender, got some really good minutes for them in the tournament, especially in that Nova game when Baz had to sit for 12 minutes in the first half, and they put Samuel in, and they were down by, I don't know what they were down by, like 15 points or something ridiculous, and they, you know, that could have been the moment, and the team came back.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always going to maintain, though, that this is the kind of team that you could make a friggin' movie about. I mean, I mean, it really is in terms of,
30 for 30.
Listen to Ollie on Gail King this morning or Good Morning America, whatever it was. I mean, he's consistent. He says the same things over and over again. And one of the big themes of what he's saying is we may not be the most talented guys out there, but we can be the hardest working.
Which is what he made his entire career on, is being the hardest worker.
And the team reflected that in the tournament, I thought. I mean, they seemed really focused, really running up and down the floor. I didn't see anybody, just jogging up and down the floor.
Say lollygagging. Say it.
I didn't see anybody lollygagging up and down the floor. No,
don't shy away from that word. It's a great word.
It is a good word. This team, I mean, I can't say enough about Ollie. And I would also be curious to see an analysis of out of timeouts. I can only speak to what I saw, but I would love to see an analysis of how our offensive efficiency was and how our defensive efficiency was out of timeouts. Mm. Because it
you hear that, Nate Silver? That's what we want to see.
Because it sure felt like we were much better out of timeouts in the postseason than in the regular season.
Yeah, well, I would have. I mean, if you would ask me during the regular season, I would have said that was a major flaw in the coaching plan. Is that they seemed unprepared.
But I don't think I remember a turnover out of an offensive timeout.
Yeah, I mean, just in general in the NCAA tournament, UConn looked better prepared and more focused than every team they played, including other teams that have, you know, national championship quality coaches in Calipari, Izzo, and Donovan at the very least.
But Michigan State and Florida with seniors on their team and experienced coaching. I mean, it was...
Well, I mean, you take the Michigan game, which is a good example, because we should not have been able to limit Michigan State to 6 points in the paint. That shouldn't have happened. And the fact that Adrian Payne had to spend his entire game behind the three-point line... I don't know exactly what the game plan was, but whatever it was clearly working, because he was talking about, you know, we're keeping him out of our yard, which was the paint, and that was the plan, and they executed it.
And
I
think
it was double teaming. They double teamed. It was the Elton Brand defense.
Right. Yeah. And they had Giffey on him for a large portion of the second half, which sort of, you know, Giffey's sort of length and speed, for as much as he lacked in physicality, just sort of disrupted Payne, I thought, and he kept them sort of hanging around the perimeter.
Glue guy.
Yeah, but he's German. They're all tough.
They're all tough.
But I want to go back to what you were talking about, sort of how you can make a movie out of this team. And I think the fact is that he's had an 18-month plan, and they've all, you know, this was back to, you know, September of 2012, when it was like, all right, we're not playing in the postseason this year, so our goal is next postseason. And I thought you saw it most clearly against Kentucky, where they don't play like a team that has played together for a long time, whereas these guys have all been playing together for a year and a half. It's essentially the exact same team as last year with, a few minor changes. And part of it was, I think, they played like they wanted it more. And they played like a real team, as opposed to just a group of really talented guys.
In California,
can we cast that movie?
I got, who is I got Shabazz? Shabazz? Who's Shabazz?
Shabazz is Michael B. Jordan.
Absolutely.
Yes, I love that. That's amazing.
Star of the latter day Friday Night Lights.
Oh God, that's amazing.
And Fruitvale Station, which was amazing.
Oh yeah, but who's Boat? Who do you get to play Boat, man?
Michael B. Jordan.
Who's Coach?
Denzel.
It's gotta be.
No, but I think the story.
I think you get Ray Allen to play KO.
Mm.
And I think I think Shabazz was misunderstood on the podium when he said, "This is what happens when you ban us."
I don't think
he was trying to say, Look at us now. You banned us, and this is what we do. I think he was trying to say, this is what happens when you remove us from contention and give us more time to prepare.
I don't.
I think he was saying, like, fuck all of you.
I think that's what he said once it all broke and he had another camera in
front
of him.
He's clever with words. He probably meant it both ways.
I absolutely think he was throwing haymakers at the NCAA.
He's so clever.
That's definitely 100% what it was.
Which I love him for.
Standing 5 feet away from Mark Emmert.
I just hope that one day when he's our coach... I hope that doesn't come back to bite him in the ass.
Mark Emmert will be. There will be no NCAA by
right.
Then.
Yeah.
By
no.
The time
it'll be
coaching UConn.
Right. It'll be the like Ohio State College of Basketball.
Can we just put that out into the universe as much as possible?
The People's Republic of College Basketball.
It'll just be Alabama football and Ohio State football, just telling UConn where to go and when.
But I thought this whole tournament was really interesting because, you know, this was supposed to be the year of the freshmen, and everybody was talking about, you know, how in every game UConn was in that they were outmatched. If you went player by player and did the matchups, that we shouldn't have won any of these games. Then, which is essentially what I talked about that entire piece. But I
mean, we shouldn't have won the last four.
Well, even
the
first
St. Joe's game, a lot of people were picking St. Joe's to win that game. You know, the fact is when you were going up against all these other teams that they're saying, oh, there's no way. I mean, we were when they were doing the pieces right before the Final Four and they were ranking the teams. Every single one had UConn as the fourth best team in the Final Four. Every single piece.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, the fact that UConn ended up with a 7 seed was absolute insanity. Like, that was just ridiculous.
Well, that Louisville had a 4.
That was stupid.
That's something I was touching on, which I thought was very funny because
they were the fourth ranked team in the nation.
Yeah.
And they had a 4.
Ranked the 13 to 16th. But the celebration, the like self-congratulatory backslapping of the NCAA, like, check out our parity, we got a 7 and an 8 seed in the championships. Like, you guys are the only fucking idiots who thought it was properly seeded in the first place. Every single you know, media outlet that covers the sport looked at your bracket seating and went, this is fucking nuts.
Yeah, they were hammered on television, right, on their then, event by their commentators.
Right, and then they get to be like, well, look, you know, this is crazy. We got a 7 and an 18. It's the highest seeded championship game. It's like, okay, but, you know, you could have made an argument UConn was a 5 seed and so was Kentucky, you know, if you really wanted to go that far. They right. certainly weren't the, you know, whatever, 21st and 28th and it, best teams in the country going in.
And if Kentucky,
and everybody knew that except the people in the committee.
Yeah. And if Kentucky was a higher seed, we might be looking at Wichita State making it much further into the tournament than they did. Maybe. I mean, they had a really tough test.
Yeah,
really
I mean, they
early.
Certainly got the shortest end of the stick by with the seeding. Although, maybe, I guess you could probably say the same
deliberate.
With Villanova.
That
what, what's that, Bruce?
Because they hate the small conference teams for some reason. So
nobody watches them on TV.
They put Wichita State in as the one seed because they had to, but they got Michigan, Duke, Louisville, and Kentucky in their bracket.
Yeah.
So
it's because when VCU or George Mason when VCU or George Mason makes a Final Four, there's nobody in those markets to turn on the Final Four and watch. So they want those teams stacked. They want them potentially, if they're a 10 seed or a 12 seed, to beat. You know, they want a Mercer to beat a Syracuse, hypothetically, as long as they can still have big markets get to the Final Four. And I do think that was sort of where they were plugging Wichita State in. I certainly don't think, you know, certainly not everybody thought Kentucky was going to beat Wichita State, especially with the year Wichita State had.
I think that was a pretty popular pick.
Yeah, but I mean, clearly potential was much higher than other
Kentucky
8-9-1 games.
Kentucky turned into a different team, though, in the tournament.
They did.
I mean, like, they brought it in the championship game for the SEC, but to that point, I mean, they still had those freshman type miss. They looked a lot like the Nerlens Noel team last year. I mean, it was.
They must have gotten a lot of extra inspiration in those unmarked vanilla envelopes handed to them from the passenger seats of SUVs.
I found it. It's sort of a.
I don't understand what that meant. Can you please explain that?
No.
After the whole, like, oh, the year of the freshman and Calipari and all his, like, it's not a one and done, it's succeed and proceed and all this nonsense. And I thought it showed that, like, you don't necessarily have to have the most talented kids on the court to win the game. I mean, they weren't the most talented team in the tournament. There's no way around that. There were more talented teams. They played against a better team. Florida was a better team all year. Something else was at play.
Michigan stayed healthy was a better team.
Right.
You know.
I mean, something else was the reason that they won those games, and I don't. I mean, I think part of it had to be the team chemistry and the whatever Kool-Aid Kevin Ollie had these kids drink in the last 18 months.
I think it was outstanding perimeter defense.
Yes,
and we don't miss free throws.
The UConn-Kentucky matchup was such a divergent teams. Like it was they were the antithesis of each other, and
totally.
Even their coaches. Some would argue, good versus evil. But
I would. I think
Neil's is like a pretty good example. Obviously, Napier's the best example of just, you know, when these teams get evaluated, especially in the preseason, everyone looks at this raw talent of like a Kentucky team or, you know, a Kansas team with Andrew Wiggins and Joel Embiid, and just is so quick to declare them, well, they're very talented, so they're going to win. And you watch somebody like Niels, who comes from, you know, 10 minutes a game shooting 26% to, you know, somebody who can play 20 minutes a game and shoot 50% from three. And it seems like in college basketball, we completely overlook the fact that, oh, yeah, people get better the longer they play college basketball.
Right. That didn't used to be the way it was.
No, I mean, not at all.
You look at some of these schools that, like, we used to watch. I mean, Vinny Del Negro sat the bench for 2 years in college and then had, like, a 16-year NBA career. That doesn't happen anymore. If you're good, you're good right away, and then you're out of there.
I mean, look at Ray Allen's freshman year and just try to compare it to the player he became, and you would – I mean, everyone knew Ray Allen was great when he was playing on UConn, and he deferred to Marshall and Sheffer. And I mean, you look at especially those tournament games in 94, and Ray, in that Florida game that they lost, he barely appears in the box score.
Yeah.
Like, Sheffer was the star player on that team. Yeah. And I mean, just to try to figure out where college basketball has come from, it just seems so obvious to look at the history of this sport and think, yeah, of course, you know, when you play with the same guys longer and you play in the same system and you can improve within that system, you're going to be better prepared to win. And it just seems like that's, I mean, maybe just because it's not as common anymore, but it's really an overlooked aspect when people are evaluating these teams. Going back to free throw shooting, and this will be a nice segue because I wrote a piece this week about Ryan Boatwright and his decision of whether or not he should go to the NBA draft. And I was just trying to look up numbers to sort of validate one decision or another. And he went 16 for 16 from the free throw line in the last four games of the NCAA tournament.
Wow.
Which I thought was really cool.
Ice in the veins. That's incredible.
Yeah. Especially compared to, you know, Napier, Boatwright was not at that quite high 80s level of free throw shooting.
When the game was
on the line in the tournament, in the tournament in general, I thought Boatwright stepped up his game. And even while, you know, I mean, for his entire career, you've kind of felt like he was capable of being this, you know, 18 to 20 point a game scorer, and he never quite got there. And it was really amazing in this tournament to watch him sort of shape his game around his current skills as opposed to trying to play up to this standard.
I think you give Boatwright a ton of credit for that, and some of that's got to be the coaching staff too. I mean, it looked like Ricky Moore must have been working with Ryan Boatwright.
He had to be.
That's what it looked like to me, because we all said it. It reminded us of Ricky Moore.
I was really impressed with the fact that he took so much pride in his defense that, like, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I bring. This is my role on this team, is to be the guy that stops the guy.
Well, yeah, and there were also moments this season where, like, you could almost see that he, when Baz came out of the game, he was like, all right, it's my time. And it was refreshing to see that he stuck, when those moments happened, when Ollie was stealing a minute for Shabazz.
Especially, what was Shabazz it in the Villanova game when Baz had two fouls in the first half? And
it was Boatwright and T-Sam.
I mean, Boatwright.
And they UConn took a halftime lead.
I think during that time, though, Boatwright played well, but he wasn't gunning. He was mm-hmm. distributing the ball. He was running the offense. And, like, I don't think it's a good time for him to test the waters in the NBA. It's not that I don't think he's a potential NBA player, but with the draft being this heavy, and his guard heavy, and next year he has an opportunity to be the guy on the team and really showcase himself.
Yeah. I don't think any of us think Boatwright should go.
The only
he's not on anybody's projected draft list.
You agree, right,
Peter? The biggest
Peter?
Question mark.
Oh yeah, he's definitely. I don't think either one should go, but I definitely don't think Boatwright should.
Yeah,
go.
Well, we'll get to Daniels in a second too.
Yeah,
I guess.
I was reading some stuff about Purvis too, and I don't think we were quite aware of what we're getting there.
I think he's going to be very, very
good.
He's
a McDonald's All-American.
I think, you know, we're in for something pretty special there if he's as advertised.
And he calls himself Perv. It's the best nickname. Name a better UConn nickname. Rip? Might be Rip?
And I've enjoyed...
Slash.
Fun is it going to be like, Perv! Just yell Perv.
Perv for
I don't
three.
Know. Boat's pretty good. Baz is pretty good. Perv. Perv.
Perv is pretty amazing.
Yes.
Yeah. This is an open call to all those Twitter followers, you know that SNL skit that said the Perv and it had the guys with the sort of cowlicks dancing around? I want Perv is photoshopped on those guys.
Make it happen.
No, but I think that has the potential to be pretty exciting. And he's also, I mean, he's going to be a junior next season, right?
Yeah.
Sophomore. It's going to be sophomore.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, he's going to be a sophomore.
He transferred after his freshman year at NC State, so he sat out, so he'll be coming in. It'll be
his third year.
It'll be his second.
You don't lose a year of eligibility.
It'll be his second eligible year, but he'll be a junior in school,
yeah.
Right?
Sure.
Yeah, no one cares about that. He's got 3 years of eligibility.
No, I'm only commenting on the fact that he's going to be an older guy on the team. He's not going to be.
It's not like he hasn't been playing basketball for the last year.
It's going to be similar.
He's been playing against Shabazz Napier in practice.
It has the potential to be similar to a Chroma situation where he comes in with some things already there that a typical freshman wouldn't have.
I mean,
well, yeah, and we've got a couple. Well, I don't think Cassell's had the same experience,
not in junior college, but he's played against better people than. A lot of high school kids. Yeah,
then a kid coming out of high school.
He's got a year or two under his belt. I mean, the thing with Purvis, too, not only did he get a year playing against Boatwright and Napier in practice, but his year at NC State was against, you know, Duke and UNC
North Carolina, and
all those ACC teams before Syracuse and Pitt went there. So, I mean, he's got, you know, experience playing against big time coaches, and he got to sit next to Kevin Ollie and his assistants on the bench.
So speaking of Coach KO, all this sturm and drang about the NBA sniffing around. He said today this is his dream job and he's not looking for anything, but he did also qualify with a never say never. I mean,
I think the only, I mean, and I'm totally speculating, but everybody's totally speculating on this, but I think the only thing that he would leave, I don't think he would leave UConn to go coach the Cavs.
Yeah.
But I do think that if like a younger team that with a solid core of players and a good organization came calling, it would give him pause. I think he would.
I also don't think he'll do
like wherever Kevin Durant ends up going.
Right. I mean, the Lakers, Knicks, and Thunder will probably all have opening. Those are marquee NBA jobs, and obviously, dependent on the scenario and stuff, he could make a lot more money. But you know, his kids go to Glastonbury High.
Yeah.
I think his son plays on the football team. Mm-hmm. His daughter goes there too. I think his mom, you know, I don't want to get too far into it, but I think his mom is battling cancer. You know, I think he just has a lot of reasons to want to stay in Connecticut. And
to the immediate
frankly,
future.
He's going to get a raise. I mean,
they kind of got to back the truck up for him. And, you know,
he's going to be making over $2 million next year.
Should we talk about Daniels a little bit?
Yeah, we have to talk about Daniels.
Yeah. So, again, I think we all probably think he should stay. But it's nowhere near like a cut and dry issue.
It's borderline.
I don't think it was even close. Obviously, he had to stay. But.
If I'm DeAndre Daniels right now, this might be my ceiling for when I can get picked.
I definitely don't think that.
Well, here's the thing too, and I mean, he's shown in these flashes the very end of last year, and then in those tournament games. He didn't have like a great game against Kentucky, but the three games before that, he was out of his mind.
He was a monster.
But if he could do something equivalent to that and get to 16 points and
he'd be a lottery
seven
pick.
Rebounds
he'd be a lottery.
All of next season. Yeah, absolutely, he'd be a lottery pick. Be a top 10 pick.
But he'd have to, I mean, he's got to put 15 pounds on in the offseason. He's got to, I mean.
If he can put numbers up, he really doesn't have to. He could play a stretch three. I mean, he'd be slow in the NBA, but he could, you know, he could play a three and sub in on a small four on a fast team.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I guess it just depends. I think. In this day and age, if you can be reasonably assured you're going to be a first-round NBA draft pick, you probably should go.
Yeah.
And I think he might have played himself into that, but I don't think it's a sure thing by any stretch of the imagination.
He's projecting at 39.
I mean, DeAndre's big problem is he hasn't been able to put together a consistent season yet. You know, he's as you talked about, he's got flashes, but
there's no
consistency there.
If the NBA draft has proven anything, though, it's that you don't necessarily need to have a great season. You need to put the right amount of games together at the right time. I mean, you look at Tyrus Thomas. Remember Tyrus Thomas on that LSU team?
I think that's the kind of thing that they may have learned from, though.
Maybe, yeah, because Tyrus Thomas obviously was a bust.
And, I mean, Daniels has never sort of had that upside that people have been waiting for. He sort of blossomed into it a little bit. You know what I mean? Like he's not a projected lottery pick that's been forced to stay in college because of his performance. He sort of played his way into that. And I was sort of the mind with how well he played at the tail end of last year. If anybody was watching UConn in their dead season, he might have been a first-round pick last year because that draft sucked.
Yeah.
That was a really shitty draft
last
year.
And that's the other thing is this is a really good draft.
But nobody was watching Daniels play. So he was throwing up 20-8 for the last six games of the season, and nobody saw it except for, you know, the people filling Gamble Pavilion.
I don't know how it translates to the NBA. That's the other piece of it. Like, I don't know how – because he's been playing the four, even he's obviously not a four in the NBA. I don't know.
You know, I don't know necessarily about that. I mean, the NBA has gotten very weird.
He's so skinny, though.
Kevin Durant's the Slim Reaper.
Yeah, but, name a, you know, there's like Kevin Love. Name another star power forward who's
it's
just
not
a
like,
classic
there's no
power
Carl
forward.
Malone's or Charles Barkley's around
right.
like blowing people
Those
up.
Those guys don't
this
exist
This is a
anymore.
Very finesse league right now.
Yeah, and you want guys that can spread the floor, and Daniels is a really, really good three-point shooter. Besides Giffey, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I would wager Daniels
is
second
two.
Best.
All right, so let's talk about our amazing women Huskies. Kicking ass and taking names. And
I enjoyed that. I
games.
Really enjoyed that championship game. That was, I mean, it was. It's funny because my dad watches. He's more of a women's team fan, and he lives and dies with every shot in the game. I mean, like he's,
like
he literally gets nervous when the score is within 15.
It's funny and how you have to like manufacture your nervousness when you root for the women.
I know.
Well, but no, I, for him, I don't think it's.
What if they don't blow them out? What will it mean?
No, but like it's so funny because I'm on the other side. I'm so used to this fucking cardiac men's team that
you're just watching to see how badly they embarrass the other team.
But like during the championship game in the first half, there was a point where it was like, you know, Notre Dame made a run to come back, but they
like
but
this might be a game.
But UConn was up what, 7 at the half?
Yeah.
And they're up 7 at the half, and I'm talking to my dad on the phone, and he's like, oh, this isn't looking good, you know. Da, 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 da. I'm like, what are you talking about? This is great. They're up 7 against an undefeated team, and they're playing really well. Like, you know, they're making plays that, like, you just don't see in a men's game. There's, like, 3 passes and then a shot.
My
it's
friend
unbelievable.
Described watching, like, 5 Bob Cousy's play, and I was like, that's not wholly inaccurate.
Yeah, I mean, the funny part about
passing center like Steph Dolson.
The funny part about that game against Notre Dame, even when the score got close, it was only because it looked like UConn was, I don't want to say they were taking plays off, but I mean, Notre Dame was not necessarily forcing the game to be close.
And Notre Dame
when
was
UConn
not.
Wanted, also, Dolson and Stewart were just getting open layups at will
Steph
for the
Dolson
entire game.
16 rebounds. Now, granted, Notre Dame was missing their post player, whose name I, of course, don't know.
No,
but,
we don't know her name.
Natalie, damn it.
Chung something. Whatever that chick's name was.
Achanwa.
And Steph Dolson was just having her way under the hoop.
Yeah, she was impressive in that game.
When
she really was.
She got that rebound, muscled up for the layup, gets fouled and comes down and it's just like,
what
is I was like so excited.
I think
about it.
I texted
fist pumping.
I clapped
my hands.
Just to give a little context, you know,
I stood up and clapped.
I just to give a little context. I in years past have taken the unfortunate stance of belittling women's basketball. And I look at it now, and I don't think it's funny anymore. I was texting with my buddies from college who we all used to joke around about that. And I was like, you know what, guys? I think I'm done with with making fun of women's basketball. I actually just pumped my fist at a Stephanie Dolson play. I mean, I think I can appreciate it for what it is right now. And it's you know, just as I mean, I found myself enjoying. Now, that's not to say that. When they're blowing out South Florida in conference play next year, I'm going to watch because I'm not.
We talked about this on the site this week. It's not as much fun to watch them beat BU by 58 points.
No.
It's just not. But the flip side of that coin is they're never going to get blown out by Louisville by 30 points. That's never going to happen.
But they also pack their out of conference schedule too. They go and play at Duke. They go and play at North Carolina.
And they play Stanford. And they play Baylor. They play everybody that could. And when they play a team that might give them a game, I watch. And then I remember when they played Duke this year. Duke was the number 2 team in the country at the time. They hadn't lost yet. And we beat them by like 20 points. It wasn't even close.
It's a pretty amazing phenomenon because it's like, you know, they're victims of their own success. Where,
yeah.
I mean, but it's all relative, I guess, because then you think of it and you're like, even the games
like watching
that,
the Globetrotters.
Well, I mean, yeah but I
except
mean, like,
without like the spinniness and flipping.
I mean, we're obsessive UConn fans and we want the UConn women to win every game, which, you know, fortunately they do. But I don't think any of the, I don't watch every game.
I don't watch every game.
Because 90% of the games are foregone conclusions. But it's funny because, you know, as the sport of women's basketball, even those games that we're not watching as what would seem they're like prime demographic, they're outdrawing and getting more TV viewers and more media attention
than anybody else
in the sport, even though they've turned the sport into this like wholly uncompetitive.
Well, every time they play an away game, they set the attendance record at the school. Every time they play an away game, it's silliness.
And it really is amazing because, I mean, you do figure every team that ever plays them is playing the game with more urgency than UConn.
Mm.
You know, like at least emotional level. If you're Baylor and you know that, you know, 2,000 people come to your home games, but when UConn comes to your arena, 10,000 people are going to come. You're going to play at a higher level than you probably do the game before against like Texas A&M.
So we're getting, I mean, people are bringing it to the ladies.
Every single game.
Every
single
game. Every team's A game.
Every year.
Every team's A game.
It looks like we're getting their A game.
Well, there's the issue, right?
I don't think we're getting Duke's A game. I think we're getting Duke's F game. They suck when they
play. They do. It's really funny.
I love it, though.
I mean, I don't think they're, you know, obviously they're, I do think they're trying hard, but that's where the other
We're
half
so
of this
spoiled.
Amazing equation comes in, where UConn has just proven to be so infinitely better than anybody they've played over the course of the last decade. I mean,
there was a spell over the last few years where Notre Dame had our number.
I know, that was terrible. They only won like two rings. You know, success has gotten so amazingly out of whack because of how incredibly good they are.
But should win four national championships. Like, that's the thing that should happen.
If she does not do it, it will be a disappointment.
Right.
Think of how nuts that is.
I said I would wear a Duke jersey and gamble if she doesn't win four national championships. You know how I feel about Duke.
I remember it was a disappointment when it didn't happen for Maya Moore. Mm. I mean, because she was the greatest thing that happened since Diana Taurasi.
And she lost in a Final Four game.
No, because Maya Moore didn't even win three championships.
Oh,
that's why people were upset.
Oh, I thought she won. I thought she won.
Because she was going to tie Taurasi and then didn't win it.
I was there when Taurasi won her three championships. That was pretty fun. Diana Taurasi was also a really, really fun player to watch.
Yeah.
You, like, never quite knew. Well, she was like the Khalid Al-Amin of the women's game. Like, you never knew what the hell she was going to do.
Do you guys want to know something?
What?
What?
I've also put together an all-time lineup for the women's Ugandan basketball.
Oh, my God.
Do it. What is it? I want to hear it right now.
All right.
Tyler's dying laughing right now.
So great.
So I've given this some thought.
Shocking.
Tina Charles at center.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rebecca Lobo at power forward.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Maya Moore at shooting guard,
mm-hmm.
or at small forward,
yeah.
pardon me. Diana Taurasi at shooting guard. And I finally settled, this one was the hardest spot, on Sue Bird at point guard.
If you picked anyone but Sue Bird, you were doing it wrong.
And is Rosati the
backup? I could have picked Jen Rosati. I could have picked
true.
Renee Montgomery.
Rosati would be my two.
That's another.
That's what I finally ended up going with, but it was very difficult.
All right, everybody, that's it for today's edition of the A Dime Back podcast. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again when we are still national champions.